Yeah, I mean, it just gives you some wrong signals. I think that's the right wording for it. One thing I look at it at is actually these consolidation ranges, like especially on the altcoins. If this moves and it just stays in a certain range for a period of time, you can be sure that enough people traded out of it so that the new high becomes the new low in a way, you know, for sufficiently many people to get to a next leg up. And that's a good sign, actually, if it just doesn't dump straight from the top, but it consolidates. Like Link did that pretty nicely from, I don't know, November till February, right? We were like in this $15 range, just going up and down and up and down. And people are like, yeah, fuck that shit. I wrote it up like a 3X and they sold it. And then there's new entry. So now we are basically on this next level here at $20. So yeah, and we traded quite, I would say like 2 months in this range, like from January to now. So it's about time to actually get to the next leg up, I think. And substantially higher. I think we will hit even like more than $60 here.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
Yeah, when things run, they're going to move very fast. And it has to run fast to basically sideline anyone who's on the waiting. And that's usually what happens. Like everyone's had their chance to buy. They decided not to. And basically like then everyone's up. The max pain, as they say, is up at this point. Because it's going to like people that are not in the market are going to start crying, basically.
Yeah. And you have to count on the greed of the guys that are up like for 4X or 5X. They're not going to sell because they're greedy enough to wait for more, right?
Well, not only greedy enough to wait for more, like many of these coins, like the Ethereum Classic I just bought, if it goes up 2 FIB extensions, that's already a 2X. But getting to all-time high, you're still like, you know, that's like $180 or something. It's now at $37. So what'll happen is, I just happen to have that chart in front of me. What'll happen is as you go up, it's not greed so much. It's just the magnetic effect of everyone expecting an all-time high break and everyone just starts piling in. So it's like, it's really that simple. And so greed, we're not at greed level until we're like, we break high and we've like kind of like gone past, you know, one or two FIB. If you got past 2 FIB extensions, you're getting into greed as far as large caps, like very large caps. If you are in mid caps, like 3 FIB extensions make sense. If not, 3 FIB extensions make sense. And, you know, and then if you go into smaller caps, then you can go to like 4 or 5 of them pretty easily.
I mean, what actually is amazing that there are some people that just wrote it all the way up in 2021 and then they wrote it all the way down again. It's like, this is like, so you have to have an exit plan. You have to have I think that's one thing also very important. It's like, okay, you set your target and you just execute. And even if it runs more, you just don't look at it again.
Yeah, no, I think like of all of the various like trading BS I found, like the one thing you need to know for crypto is just basically, you know, long time frame, FIB retracements and extensions. And the extension analysis has been really fun to figure out in that, like, there is quite a bit of predictive information there, especially when you couple it with market cap size, FIB extensions, which cycle are you in, new coin versus, you know, like brand new coin versus not. And you break all of that down, you can easily come up with a plan for each type of coin. It's really pretty interesting. Like, it's just a probability plan that you can create for each style of coin. Hey, Mo.
Sophie, what's your prediction for Link, taking into account the FIB extensions and the stuff you say?
For Link, like, my theory was that a rational target for Link would be something in the a very typical move would be to 145. Why? Because that's just only 2 extensions off the previous high. However, usually for a cycle 2 asset, you run 3 extensions off the high. If it's a high quality asset like Link, that would put it at $250 or $234, I'm sorry, is where that would be at. So I think it has the possibility of doing that, The best example of that was Ethereum last cycle. And that's exactly like 5,000% gain from the very, very bottom. In Link's case, that's $5, you know, with a top of like around 240, 250. And that's pretty much what Ethereum did last cycle. So this is a cycle two asset. Like last time, Ethereum was a cycle two asset. So each coin is in its own like bull cycle, right? Like the first cycle is the one after you first release the coin. The second cycle is the one after that and the one after that. So this is what I mean by cycle one, cycle two for each asset is different. So Link here is a cycle two, like 240 to me looks rational as a theoretical top. Now, does that mean like, do you wait for that amount or do you front run it? I think if you get to like this 143 level, it's quite plausible that people are going to be like 200, 200, 200. They'll cheerlead, you know, to maybe get to 200 at least. But I think the 143 to 234 range makes sense if you look at like lots and lots of crypto charts and how these things move. Again, none of this is a guarantee. People will be like, oh, I'm going to buy it. And I'm like, you said to sell it such and such. I'm like, I don't know. This is all just like my just sort of prediction levels to some extent. Like if you were to say, what do I think the odds that we're going to get to all-time high are? I would say like 99.9% for Chainlink. And that's a 2.5x from here. What are the odds you're going to get to 102 Chainlink? I think the odds are probably like in a full bull market, usually like at least 90%. What are the odds we're going to get to 143? I think the odds of that are probably close to probably 70%, right? Something like that. And what are the odds you get to 250 Link? Maybe it's like 50%. I don't know. You know, that's kind of the, you just have to pick your numbers. And some people like to sell all the way up. Some people like to pick at least a basic level to hit and then sell. What I'm going to do personally is I'm going to wait for at least the first fib level and then beyond, first fib extension and beyond to do any kind of selling of anything this season. Is my theory. Now, who knows? Maybe we don't have a big alt season like we did last time. I don't know. I don't know for sure. So this is all predicated on liquidity showing up and people want to play with their Chuck E. Cheese tokens at the casino and dump a bunch of money in here. And it also predicates on the very bullish idea that Bitcoin ETF cash flows and maybe Ethereum ETF in the next year could drive a lot of new flows into the crypto space that wasn't there before and pump everyone's bags. And the higher these other coins go, the longer the altcoin market also lasts and the higher the tops can be. So you could make a list almost of like negative things, like for example, inflation, you know, people don't have enough money to buy crypto. You can make that argument. You could make the argument that interest rates are high, so it's expensive to borrow money, which might be a bullish thing in crypto because there's always too much borrowed money anyway. Maybe you don't want it to pump that fast. Maybe it'll pump, like, maybe the bull market will last a lot longer because there's not as much leverage, not easy to borrow money these days. That could be good. Maybe these are all spot buys and retail is not going to get as wrecked this time because of it. That's a possibility. On the other hand, you have the Bitcoin ETF stuff with lots of flows coming in. So this time is very different from previous cycle. This is the first Bitcoin cycle that's happening with very high interest rates and quantitative like tightening, relatively speaking. It's just different. And this is the first time we've had ETF. So one's a negative, one's a positive. What's the final effect? I don't know. No idea. But I do know this, that the Bitcoin, the crypto market cap as a whole is relatively small compared to the rest of the stock market and the financial markets. And one of the positive catalysts here is the stock market's up. Because the stock market's up, what does that mean? That means you legitimately could have a lot of excess cash floating around that people can swap from crypto, whatever, I mean, from stocks into crypto and vice versa down the risk curve. So if the stock market wasn't pumping or wasn't doing reasonably well, then I'd be a little bit more nervous. But I think on the whole, the positives outweigh the negatives in my mind, especially when you include a strong stock market and ETFs available at the same time. people are going to, if Bitcoin takes a dip, guess what people are going to do? They're going to go buy, take some of their stocks, their dividends, and they're going to go buy some more BTC probably. Some people are. And that will have a tendency to keep money flowing into the space. So, yeah, like positives and negatives, probably everyone here can probably list them on, you know, their two hands because we've heard it for the last 2 years. But, you know, when you listen to it all at one time, you kind of get to wrap your head around this. But so tops, I would say, Mo, you say like how high can Chainlink go? I think if we have a relatively more bullish cycle, you know, capital flowing in is much heavier than Chainlink 240 and stuff. Probably so. If it turns out that it's not the case and money doesn't show up, then you're talking about more like 143, I think. Anyway, hopefully that helps. Sorry to send a message to somebody. But anyway, yeah, I mean, what's his name? Crypto Dad was on here yesterday. He's like, oh, I think Bitcoin's going to crash. And he's like, he had a short going on. I was like, dude, like, I don't know, shorting during a Bitcoin breakout doesn't seem like the most obvious of trading position to me. He was all over it. He's like, I'm kind of mostly in stables and stuff. And I think that's a good thing. Like if people are acting like that and they're mostly in stables, then we know we have a lot of upside left to go because those stables have to have somewhere to go. So those folks who are, so if we have a breakout here and we keep running, then people who are on the sidelines are just going to completely go crazy next. Like they're going to start buying everything up. Watch. Because like in a minute here, you can see where all the volatility's dropped, things have pulled back. People are like, wait, is the market going to go up or is it going to go down? I'm pretty convinced it's going to go up, but not everyone is. So if we go up, then all of those people are just going to pour into the market all of a sudden, dumping all their money in immediately, right? So that makes for the gigantic giga impulse, like wave, like impulse two of this cycle. And this would pretty much send a lot of altcoins just straight vertical over a period of usually like a couple of months, right off their all-time highs and just blast off. So I wouldn't listen to anybody's like FUD at this point, really. It's like, you know, like just like I would just sit there and wait. And you know, like I did today, I bought a bunch of coins. And if they dip, then I'll get some more, you know, top off my bags, have them already. No big deal, right? Like, you know, like think about this. If you had a 50% dip in altcoins today, do you think there would be buyers? I think so. These Twitter spaces have like three times the number of people of like three months ago. So you know there's going to be a bunch of people buying shit because everyone's paying attention now. So I'm pretty convinced that like dips will be bought. So even if I buy a position in anything now, the odds that like it's going to come back up is very high in my mind. And that's the thing. Remember, like in bull markets, you know, every dip just takes a little while. Give it a few weeks and you're going to pump, right? It's not like a bear market, which is really slow and boring, and like, you know, you know, the each retracement takes 3-4 months, you know, and then you do that again, and then it comes back up, and then it retraces again 3 more months, and then again and again, and we had like a year and a half of that, right? Boring. But here, the difference is that these dips are going to not last very long, and they won't be quite as deep, so you'll just have to decide. So like, on all of my bags that I bought today, like, I bought a bunch of crap, like, Aerodrome and storage and engine coin, a bunch of junk that I just bought on Coinbase just to buy it just for fun. All of these, what I'm just going to do is if they dip 10%, if I see a $1,000 position go to 900, then I'll go ahead and top it off with one little extra buy. If I see that position then again go to 900, that means like, or even lower, let's say 850 or 800, I'll double the entire position. And I'll just do that all the way to the very bottom of all these coins. Now, it might be that they just pump and I don't get the opportunity to do that, but I'm okay with that. It's fine. Because these are all just bags I'm just playing video games with. So I'm just going to martingale every single one of the things I bought today with the intention that it's a bull market and that's just what you do. And the opportunity cost in time is low because your moves are so fast. Whereas in a bear market, it's like, oh, shit. Like, okay, my capital has to sit there for 6 more months while this thing retraces. So it's a relatively easier thing right now. Second here, 1 minute, I've got to do something real fast. Kind of multitasking here. I need to CT scan someone's head. The new apps for some of the apps we use, or just the platform that we use in hospitals, like, you know, the Epic platform for medical is really, really good. Like a nursing staff, for example, can message us with like patient context. You know how normally you'll get a text message, but it won't be categorized as anything when you get a text message from somebody. So it says, you know, check out so-and-so's, you know, whatever, you know, their labs or whatever. It's not, you have to then go look up that person. In this case, when the message comes to you, it's already in the context of that patient. All you do is hit the top and you get to that exact person. Like, oh, okay, the potassium's low, you can go on the app and replace it, or you know, CT head, whatever, okay, go for it. So, and it goes right to your phone app. So it's like, that's why I can sit here just like monkey around while I'm ordering these things for people as the different folks need them. So it's kind of funny that way. It's like what's way more efficient now with some of these newer systems. Taking a long time though. Computing systems in healthcare take fucking forever to get good. They're just now getting to that level where they're really good.
Mm.
Yeah, I think the fear in the market at the current Bitcoin level is really whether we're going to liquidate the long positions at $65,000. That's really the fear right now. If that happens, and we have a drop for that, great. Then I'll just sort of add to all these alt bags, which will all dip, right? Like, that's the beauty of Bitcoin dips, is they'll dip your altcoins. That's actually a blessing for you, like if you're a buyer. If you're just waiting for your bag to go up, and you're like, oh shit, here we go again, I have to wait longer, that's different. But if you have cash and you're sitting on the side and you can add to things, then each of those dips can be a good thing. And BTC sort of like inordinately drops your alt bags more. So basically the way you look at it is in alt season, which is where I think we are now, the way you can identify it is for each percentage increase in Bitcoin, like let's say BTC's, it shows in my little trading view thing that it's like up 0.66%. This thing is not very accurate, but anyway, but if you look at like other coins like Doge, it's up 1.17%, right? Litecoin's up 1%. So what you're seeing there is that alts are actually slowly gaining on the upside, even though they get nuked on the downside. They eventually get to the point where these numbers are much more pronounced, where, you know, like BTC will be up 2%, but Doge will be up, you know, 20% or something like that. And you'll start seeing this happen. And then as time goes on, that effect becomes more and more pronounced. And then you know, because then what happens is the altcoin market cap, like Total 2 and Total 3, they're going to explode. And when they explode, that's what we call like altcoin dominance or whatever. And you know, you can really get gigantic moves during those times where the altcoin space is basically catching up to BTC. So that's what a lot of people do. They'll buy BTC early in the market when everything crashes, run it up, and then wait. And then they'll wait like a year while BTC runs. And then wait for the first altcoin impulses, which we just saw this last month in a lot of coins. Some of them are actually we saw in October as well. But they'll wait for those impulses, and then they'll jump in. And then in the meantime, everyone was entertaining themselves with AI token, AI coins, and they were entertaining themselves with like Caspa and a few other runners. I'm curious to really see, like, do the things that ran, like the coins that have been running so far, do they continue to run? Or do they lose steam and people get bored of them? That's the real question. I think things like Caspa probably have still room left to run because there's not really any FUD there. And like, you know, you have a rabid community. And the altcoin season sort of just getting started in many ways. So they could do fine. Also it's possible that after this first few months, some of these might cool down the same way Chainlink did back in 2021. And the second half of the bull run, you know, you might have stuff underperform that was otherwise doing well in the beginning. I think like Ethereum Classic's the one that's probably going to moon with more obvious conviction here. Dogecoin is, I think, it's a more obvious one. And the reason these two are obvious is because when ETH runs, for its break of all-time high, which I think is very close, ETC will generally do the same thing. And I think from here, it's a pretty good 10x. The other one is, and that's just a 10x, only to one FIB extension past all-time high, by the way. It's being kind of conservative. The second one, Doge, of course, like it's just the attention king. When it goes up, like the entire world knows it because like everyone starts telling their friends and shit. So I think Doge is like more obvious here, like as well, like the meme coin king. Nobody has any misconceptions about what it is too. What's Dogecoin? I don't know. It's something about a dog, but I know it goes up like crazy. That's all people have to know, right? It's like a global gambling token essentially. So I think it's likely to go. Yeah, there's other meme coins and this and that, but still, I think when the herd shows up, like even the crypto natives are going to jump and go buy Doge this time. I did, and I think everyone will because it's just such an obvious like it's a flag you can rally around. Sort of, it's like the meme coin king. It's like BTC is the actually technically BTC is the original meme king, but you know Doge is like the meme queen or something. But yeah, I think that will do fine from here. Yeah, everything's trickling up right now.
Hey, Steffi, what was that yesterday with Shin actually going apeshit on Coach Bruce's IQ? It's kind of... it's actually sending Bruce some messages.
She was upset about that. I thought Bruce is pretty smart.
Yeah, she triggered her. It's really like, I don't get it. You know, I honestly, I don't give a shit about other people's IQs.
Right, right. It's not like that. It's just, but at the same time, I wouldn't necessarily I'd fade it either. Like people LARP a lot about like these things, you know, it's like, you know, how smart are other people, this and that, and the other thing. And like, it can sometimes be hard. At some level, it's easy to tell because like that people have pretty good depth of knowledge, obviously. But it's harder to gauge things like IQ unless you've met a lot of people with high IQ. Then you start getting a little bit more of a like, you know, you can put your finger in the wind and kind of get a sense of it. Mm. But yeah, Bruce does not strike me as a dummy. That's for sure.
No, and you know, there's one thing I would put out there without hesitation is that people with a higher IQ actually not tend to be really like, let's say, negative about their life or other people. You know, they like it takes a part of your intelligence to actually be able to be above things and control your emotions. I think that's also some part of what real intelligence is to me. You know, that someone is actually
yeah. Another interesting feature of very high intelligence is typically people become less materialistic too, interestingly enough.
Yeah.
Which makes sense as to why, like, you know, Germany's a fairly high IQ country, for example. It's not a surprise that someone like it's not a surprise that someone like we talked about Karl Marx a little bit yesterday. Mm. It's not a surprise that someone like Karl Marx would emerge from a place like Germany. Why? Because you have a relatively high average IQ population. And when that happens, you could, in theory, make some forms of socialism work. Where it doesn't work is when you have gigantic discrepancies in the worker base, essentially, right? When you legitimately have like people with, you know, IQ 130s competing with IQ 80s, and you think for some reason that like the IQ 30 person, 130 person is going to somehow be like doing worse than the 80 person most of the time. This is not going to be the case, right? So it's hard to make things like that work. So it's not surprising to me that like socialism ideas, for whatever they are, emerged from places like that, right? Like it makes perfect sense. And when you have to deal with tons of sort of lower IQ populations, you'll notice that democracy and republics and things, they don't work that well. And what you wind up with is like chaos. I mean, like look at Haiti today, for example. It's a shit show, right? So what you wind up with is chaos, and usually those type of places work better with both dictatorships or theocracies, one of the two. And you'll notice that every time the US or somebody goes in and breaks up some dictatorship in the name of democracy, they fuck up the whole country. Because what you need to make democracies and republics work is you have to have a reasonably high average intelligence. In the US in particular, if you let everyone show up and it's not vetted based on, you know, like, you know, relative, you know, knowledge and what have you, then you're not going to have a middle class. You're going to have a serf class, because it's very difficult for a person with an IQ of 80, and then not being rude to anybody in the room here, but like, it's very difficult to get really high paying jobs because most of those things are information age jobs, right? Like you're simply not, you're going to have a huge wage difference between folks, obviously. And as a result, you're going to get a lot of discontent and chaos.
Yeah, I mean, but I don't know how this is actually unfolding in the US, but at least in Germany, I would say we can see that. What's the right word? So there's kind of a institutionalization of democracy, where they basically are telling the, or let's say they're arguing that the plebs don't have the, let's say, the proficiency to actually judge any new regulation or whatever in a proficient way. So it's like we know there's like they call it expertocracy or something, like we have these experts that you're supposed to listen to, right? And so they're basically saying that the citizens are not able to handle complex issues properly. And the other thing is that you basically have to listen to the ones that know better, like these experts, right? And the second thing is that you want to constitutionalize a majority of the citizens. So you basically say they don't really have the proper morals or ethics because they're not properly educated in moral or ethics, and they will do something wrong, right? So they're basically telling that they have an underdeveloped sense of moral and ethics, and that's why they're not supposed to have a part in all these democratic decisions, right? So that's the other hand, what's arguing against these liberal democracies. At least that's what we see in Germany, right?
Yeah, like if you look at like the US as a republic early on, most of the voter base was kind of at a certain level, essentially. And the lower you take that level, the more likely you're going to get everyone voting for just free money for themselves.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't work long term. This is why socialism doesn't work too, by the way, because ultimately
it's the
people at the top always become kings in that system as well. So there's no system on this planet where like the rich don't get richer, and there's no system on this planet that doesn't result in some kind of Darwinian mechanism, regardless of like what type of economic shenanigans you try to paper over all that with, right? Like I think at the end of the day, evolution and Darwinianism like just basically takes its toll on everybody, no matter how what you do.
I agree. I think the most important thing is that, at least from my understanding, is that whatever system you're running, it just should be able to actually max out the profitability of your economy. Because as long as you stay profitable, you can afford all this stupid shit, right?
You can afford to make a lot of mistakes when you're rich.
Yeah.
Or if you have high resources.
The poor and the sick and whatnot, right? I mean, all these good things that you can do actually are just able if you are having a lot of excess profits or excess energy, if you want to call it.
And excess energy, really. Yeah. That's the main thing.
And so you don't want to have any politics in place that are just detrimental to proper flourishing economics for whatever reason, you know. And that's what I have a beef with politicians. If they don't take this as the prior premise, that they have to max out this because everything else comes from that, then I think they should be kicked out of office, you know, because they're just too fucking stupid to understand how this thing should be run, right? It's like, just whatever you want to do, you know, you have to have money first.
At some level, I think, like, Europe in particular, I think Europe in particular, in some ways, got advanced technologically, obviously, because of all the warfare, World War One and Two. But at the same time, like, it probably set back Europe in many ways. Because everyone was just fighting amongst themselves, as opposed to like
just the fact that you're able to wage such wars already demonstrates how much excess of energy you had, right?
Exactly. That's a good point. That's an implication in and of itself, right? Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, who goes to war?
You have too much energy and not sure what to do with it. You just go and try to kill each other with it.
Yeah, something like you strive for more power just for some stupid targets for no particular reason, and I think. And that's also something that I think these people in power are not educated in, right? I mean, it's like we don't have any requirements for someone. You know, you You get to be a politician. Anyone can be a politician. It's not like you're a doctor, right? You have like 10 years of proper education, so they let you stick your fingers into someone's open belly, right? And it better be like that, because I don't want to have some idiot like putting the fingers in my belly unless it's an emergency, right? And there's no one else around. And with politicians, it's basically someone that has a a big mouth, right? Run the fucking country, you know? It's like, it's not very, doesn't sound very promising to me, you know? Probably the biggest idiots, they get to be. So I don't know, yeah. It just sounds stupid of a concept to me. It's like, I don't know. It doesn't seem really like thought through. But then again, I mean, in the administrations, we still have like people that prepare the data for them and help them with decisions. And
another thing is interesting too, is like, if you have a country with like a relatively low education system, low IQ, low resources, and they're not doing very well. Okay, fine. You can understand that. But when you have like industrialized nations that have plenty of smart people in them, somehow self-sabotage them or go to war with each other or whatever, it's like an order of magnitude clusterfuck, right? Like it's like a whole different level of insanity in some sense. And that makes you wonder too, like, does intellect actually lead to better outcomes necessarily? In many cases, it doesn't. Like, intellect is what led to World War One, II, and whatever, right? Like, at very, very large scale wars, bigger than ever before. And it was intellect that made that happen. So that's why some people argue that, like, maybe you can be too smart for your own good at some level as well.
Oh, yeah.
So this is the balancing factor of, like, should only elite people be running governments and stuff? Maybe not. You know, is your outcome legitimately going to be better? Possibly not.
Yeah, I think it's like the combination of also emotion and intelligence. It's not very highly valued in today's economies, right? Like there's some approaches and some PR departments, they're getting better at it, even bigger companies, right? They're getting wrong most of the time because they're like talking about inclusiveness and they're throwing parties for unicorns and whatnot. I think that's not the right way to do it. But it's largely an area where people don't talk about, you know, it's like a mental sanity and like people don't getting enough kids. And it's not a topic that you usually argue in today's society. It's like, oh yeah, we have too few kids, but no one's really talking about it. Like it's a real problem. And it is, right. So we are as a humanity, we are not there yet to actually accept these things that we are like, we have this stupid primal emotions that are still working within us and they're making us do very unreasonable things. And we are not even educating kids like in school that they should control their emotions. There's some attempts like for whatever bullying classes or whatever, right? They do this today now in schools, but on most of the time, they're completely missing out. They're like giving up on schools, right? It's like, okay, this is a problematic school and there's all the bad kids go there and they fight and we put some security guards in the entrance so they don't get the guns inside, right? It's like, great idea, you know, why you don't try to get them to understand how emotions unfold and work? Like, there's no education on that end, right? And it's the same for, I mean, we're completely as a society, as a humankind, we're still missing out on that completely. It was a complete bummer to me because people need to understand that they're in a way like
that. I've noticed that it's very hard to find like people with fairly good, reasonably good emotional intelligence balanced with reasonably good just IQ or whatever. When you to get that package all in one,
it's rare.
And find that consistently so that you can put everyone of those type of people in positions of some, you know, political position or something like that is very uncommon.
Yeah.
It's a difficult thing to accomplish. Not to mention you have to have those people also have a fairly deep level of sort of like understanding about how the universe works on top of everything else.
Yeah, but mind you, there's also some part that there is no training at all for this. So people might have this kind of ability, but it's not appreciated. It's not actually addressed properly, even in childhood or in education.
Well, I think part of it is we don't know how to identify it very well early enough. This is a problem like the military.
No one cares, you know? I mean, this big issue there is that, like, no one really, until today, no one really cares about these things. It's like you put it in the esoterical corner with drug users and whatnot, right? I mean, it's like, okay, there's this this crowd, and it's not, but I think it's a big part of humankind, you know. Most of the shit that happens in the world today, the really bad things, are basically emotion driven, right? The irrational things, the irrational decisions, they all are emotionally driven. It's like someone gets mad and then whatever, something stupid happens, you know, completely out of whack, doesn't make any sense to anyone that this person did that, right?
This is where the AI has to tell you, hey, you're being emotional, man. Don't
yeah,
do that.
Yeah.
And
obviously, I mean, just on a daily basis, look how many people you meet a day that don't have the emotions, and they don't even realize that they're complete slave to their own brains. Like, they act up on something that pisses them off, and they ruin their day for themselves, for the other persons, right? And for no particular reason, it's just because they think like, whatever, you know. I mean, you know what I'm talking about. This is like completely irrationally getting upset with something and really getting upset. I mean, it's not just like a little bit like frowning or something, but really like expressing it like vocally and screaming, worst case, or even pushing people around.
Well, you also have just like in the world, there's just bona fide psychopaths and sociopaths too. They do all sorts of crazy shit that has like, and it's not exclusive to only like, say, quote unquote, dumb people. There's plenty of people that are smart that are fairly nefarious as well. And that's the other problem with these things. Like, these utopias never really quite work because you,
definitely, because it's the next level,
sort of like the bad apples or whatever.
That's the next level. You have these guys that are, they're really like unhinged, right? The brain is completely malfunctioning. It's like, to me, it's like there are people with malfunctioning brains, and then there are people with really malfunctioning brains. So it's like,
yeah, like really, really, really malfunctioning brains. Yeah, different levels. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, to some extent, we all have this animal inside of us, right? It's just nothing we can deny. It's just how evolution works. They're like these emotions. They just prove to be a proper mechanism of whatever in the past, right? So for procrastination or for looking for food or just behaving proper socially. I mean, they all have their reasons to exist, right? But in our modern societies, they're what do you call it, super, I don't get the word. It's like they're not necessary anymore. What's the word for it? Super. Yeah. Anyway, so you don't need them anymore. And
superfluous.
Yeah, superfluous, right? That's
the word. I think is the word you're looking for. Yeah, superfluous. Yeah.
And that's it, you know. And we don't know how to cope with them. They're still there. We just can't switch them off, right? And if they don't have a way to actually act out, they're kind of like a, I don't know.
So you can speak like three languages then, right?
Me?
Yeah. You speak German, Chinese, and English?
And Spanish.
Yeah. And Spanish.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. So anyone that can learn four languages is usually pretty sharp, generally speaking. That's just pretty much a given.
Yeah, but Spanish, I'm a little bit rusty. It takes me a while to actually warm up on Spanish. But I can watch a movie or the TV in Spanish, no problem. I understand everything. It's just like you need to practice for your mouth to actually get the vowels out right, right? It's like Spanish is, it's like to make it sound nice, to make it sound proper, it takes a little bit of, it's an emotional language, put it that way. It's not as easy as Chinese in pronouncing. Chinese can be pretty flat, you know, as a language, and it doesn't make a difference. But if you talk like that in Spain, people probably fall asleep, you know. They're all like,
oh, people think you're like, they'll think you're autistic or something.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. No, but it's also,
or you'll just look like, you just seem like some kind of like flat affect kind of character.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, but anyways, I mean, it's many languages. And people always ask me how did you learn this and that. I don't really know. You know, it just comes to me. It's just I'm just listening to people and that's it.
I think more Europeans tend to have more like multilingual anyway.
That's true.
Right now.
That's true. Like Belgium, for example, there's people that speak like Dutch, French, and German all at the same time. But then again, there's also elements in all the three languages from each other, which is, well, I would say Dutch and German are much more close than actually the French to the German. I mean, Latin languages.
Germans are generally like, I think like average IQ is like 105 or something. It's pretty high.
Well,
the thing is, like, you're talking about a group of people that are more probable to be able to learn multiple languages well. You can tell also in like the obsessiveness with engineering detail. So if you look at like Japanese, Germans, like both do really, really well in various engineering tasks and such. Like, for example, metallurgical skills, like German steel, Japanese steel, these are some of the best like products in the world, right? And it reflects a certain kind of like obsessiveness to detail as well, which like Zeiss lenses, for example, or Germany and Japan, like look at the products that are produced in both places.
Yeah.
Things that require extraordinary amounts of precision and like high quality manufacturing. That would be like, look at steel, look at glass and lenses and these type of things, right? Like they're pretty good at these things.
Yeah, it's even other stuff that people mostly don't see. It's like even construction. If you look, for example, what kind of tools they use today in Germany when they pour concrete, like these molds or something. It's like the systems they're using, they're like outworldish, right? Even for something rudimentary like that. If you really look at it, how they do it right now, it's like, wow.
You're talking about like board form concrete and such?
Yeah, it's crazy, man. You know, it's like almost a machine can do it today. It's like they can, I'm sure like in 10 years, they have robots that can do the entire concrete structure. You don't need any human workers anymore. They're that far already. You know, it's like, it's just some stupid things that climbing around there and putting the molds and pouring the concrete all the time and getting the rebars and stuff like that. So it's really weird, you know. It's like this little tinkering is going back on in the background, and no one sees them. But it's like in a lot of areas they actually kind of specialize. They just like to do this like specialized niche markets. Actually, I'm doing the same thing here with my company in China. It's pretty much the same. I just went into a niche and I'm dominating it, you know. So, yeah. Yeah, I would say I'm probably the biggest one in the world right now in my little particular niche. And yeah, and then that's where the fun starts, right? Where you can actually really
put. Do you make specific parts for like a very specific thing, or like do you produce a full product or what?
It's a full product. Yeah, it's a full product.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, yeah, maybe one day I'll box, you know. it's just like I have too much political opinions, especially when I eat something in German or some shit.
Yeah, it's not really worth it.
Yeah, can like, actually,
but like bragging to randoms on the internet doesn't help you too much, basically. So it's like there's no point in doing it.
Yeah, it's like you don't want to have anyone throwing shit at your company sign, you know, on Facebook,
right?
Or it's like,
or some, yeah, exactly.
The CEO said that bullshit, you know. He's a full blown Nazi or something, you
know? Or something. Yeah, like. That's just how this goes. You go straight from being like angel to Nazi immediately, right? That's how how social media and all that shit works.
You just say, oh, there was another stabbing in Germany and this was some Syrian guy involved, you know, and that's it, you know. It's just you have 1 month of pain for your company, and then your distributors call you and say, what the fuck, man, you know. And you haven't opened your mouth, just do whatever you're doing, you know. It's like, don't talk publicly. So yeah, it's not really worth it. So I'm not really worried about anything.
It's more entertaining when you don't have to worry about all that shit.
Yeah, and there's really like toxic people out there on Twitter, you know. Sometimes I just on purpose I troll, you know, and it's like you get really a lot of comments like you idiot, you know, and yeah, just go and fight for the Russians, you know.
Now if you say anything regarding war on Twitter,
yeah,
you're clearly going to upset like gigantic hordes of people.
It's crazy, yeah. I mean, you stay pretty much out of it. This stuff, you know, it's like I'd say you probably, if you ever wanted to post, you have to use an alt account because you ruined the engagement for this account.
Exactly. Like some of your followers that like you for some crypto shit don't like your stance on Haiti or something or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, they're upset with you. Like, and they're like, wait, go back to posting about Chainlink, bro. Or whatever, like you're gonna make our bags go down and whatever. Like, yeah, that's a thing for sure.
Yeah, it's true to some extent. It's like you just have to compartmentalize. I guess that's the right word, right? So
you do, because like people associate with you whatever the fuck, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same for
politics
for you as a doctor,
especially because this is a worldwide audience. So the thing is, like, there are people from legitimately everywhere, and you're gonna upset someone all the time, no matter what. Like, no matter what you say, you're going to upset somebody for some reason.
Yeah, definitely. It's a given, you know, it's just a multipolar word. It's just supposed to happen, I guess. But then if you promote something, you just, well, let's say not just promote, just want to talk about something in particular. You don't have a reason to actually.
You'll be talking about the rotation of the moon around the earth and people complain about, like, you know, like, how do you know there's a moon or whatever? Like, it's like, wait, what? like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, that's just completely absurd conversations about nothing.
Yeah, we have them sometimes here. You know, we have some guys that put out some theories that are really like, okay, it's not like you just want to be
polite. Well, it's a good test to see if, like, you can kind of, like, cohesively respond to, you know, to questions that are otherwise seemingly simple, right?
Mm.
So it's a good mental exercise to do from time to time just to refresh your own mind. By the way, the question about yesterday, somehow or another we got on the subject of, like, whether photons have mass or not. I think that's still highly debated. It's like, there's this concept, by the way, that when light is actually in motion, there is no actual mass. It's like the nature of the speed of light. So, but the thing is, like, then how do you calculate its momentum and this and that? And then, you know, you kind of get to this derivation where you have this rest mass concept. And I don't think that's really, like, well conceptualized, the concept of a rest mass measuring this sort of thing.
It's a tricky topic. I mean, they just...
Because are light particles ever really at rest? And the answer is basically really, really not. Because so you're really calculating something on pure theory that... But as far as any calculation goes, it's basically a massless thing. Anyway, that's the story. So,
yeah, I think, you know, in a way, I mean, there's a lot of theories because it's just like you have a certain, let's say, a model where you can make calculations or predictions, and it has to fit to a part into that model. So you just have to call it like it's massless. So it works with my model, but another model would require it to have a residual mass to work with the other model. In the end of the day, I guess it's just.
But also in theory, you'd have to have a Higgs boson in it to have mass, I suppose, too. At least by the way mass is now defined.
I would say, you know, it's much more or less like with this tricky thing with quantum physics. At all, it's like as soon as you measure it, it has a mass, right? But on the other hand, it actually carries just energy. If you measure it, it just has energy. If you measure it for mass, it just has mass, right? It's like this kind of duality.
It's like duality. It's not, it's like particle versus wave.
Yeah, it's just like it shifts in and out of these two states, right? It can transmit energy, but then it also disappears mass-wise, right? If it exerts the energy on the other end, it's kind of this this kind of weird
basically, thing. Light is basically like a type of magic.
Yeah, it's just like a magnetic and electric wave function at the same time. You know, it's like how these photons actually propagate through space. It's like they exert an electromagnetic wave, and it's like, I don't know if you have seen these models how these waves actually propagate through space. I mean, the whole concept tells you that it's not a single particle or something. Like we want to see these things as single units, but probably there's no way to actually describe it. You know, it's just energy and mass states like going in and out of each other, and we're probably not even able to describe it in detail. It's just, and we don't. I would say, you know, as long as we can actually abstract it in a way that it works for us in technical realms, what we do with most of the time, anyways, you know, because you're not able to tell anyone what's a magnetic field. It's just there, right? But how does this actually propagate through the air, and why is it there? You know, we just talk about a force, right? But what's the weak force and what's the strong force? No one can really tell you how that's transmitted through space, right? I mean, what's really there?
What causes them precisely and all
that? Yeah, it's like with gravity, the same thing. It's like no one knows what's really there, you know, and gravity is actually pretty weak of a force compared to the other ones, right? I mean,
right.
It's like by many magnets.
Gravity is the weak force.
Yeah, which is kind of doesn't make sense to anyone, right? If you talk to a normal person, someone that's not into physics, they would say, oh, gravity is probably pretty strong, right? Because we're not thrown into space, right? We're standing on the Earth, but it's actually the weakest of all of them. It's just kind of humans don't have a good grasp for these abstract models, or like intuitively, right? So which makes it like you really have to have a weird brain to be actually able to. It just doesn't come natural, I would say, to most people, these kind of concepts. And but what I think is interesting is how AI will actually
You can tell like something about when's like if you start sitting through like, you know, physics classes, you know, one after the other, you're like, oh shit, I'm not smart enough for that. Like you'll notice that pretty quickly. There'll come a point where you're like, oh, I don't think I get it. And that's including the stuff that's already been discovered, right? Like it's like you might have a conceptual vision of it, but you know how like, you know, you and me can probably visualize a 3D object in our head, right?
Mm.
But there's people that can't do that. And then there's visualizing things like relativity in your head. That's a much harder thing to do as you go higher and higher up the ladder of like theoreticals. And it's actually not possible to imagine multidimensional space, for example, in your head.
Well,
like M.C. Escher, the artist, you know, the, you know, this,
yeah.
I forget the name of the art piece where, you know, have the, you know, you're walking up these stairs.
It's not just one.
Yeah. It's thought that M.C. Escher had a very, very high level of like ability to consider something that might be he's the one of pretty much anyone that's ever lived that's thought to have some idea of how to visualize a multidimensional space. I think he was among the most talented at that capability and expressing it. Pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So like not everyone's going to become an M.C. Escher that easily, in other words.
Yeah, this Dutch guy. Yeah, I think the multidimensionality is, it's just like, you see, for example, the AI, they're based on a mathematical vector model, right? And usually right now on LLM, they use like, if you call these directions, like these tensors, which are really just multidimensional vectors. So basically, if you have one node that connects to another node, so there's something in that model that's trained. It's basically, there's a weight connecting it to the next information piece. That's how the theory works, right? And this is also a multidimensional model because one node can have, like today's LLMs, I think they use like 100 or what vectors, so it's like 100 dimensions where it builds connections to other nodes, right? And the whole thing, what actually is underlying, the math that's underlying an LLM is a mathematical sorting function. So to quickly actually, let's say you take a word like blue, for example, and it's able to go through its entire learned model and sort this like, okay, where's the blue? Where's anything related to blue? And then it goes all, and it's very efficient on actually finding all the nodes in an instant that are more or less, and weight what's related to blue. So you actually have the nodes that have the most information about blue and then the lesser ones. And that's actually how, interestingly, AI works. It's like it's a multidimensional mathematical model. In its basics.
But even our mind is interesting in that, like, if I tell you the word blue,
it's the same. Like, that's the same how the brain works, right? I mean, on the oldest.
If you observe how it works specifically, like if I ask you to think of the first thing you consider with the color blue, you might think, oh, I don't know, you know, the flag of a country, or you might think, you know, the color of someone's shirt, or whatever, right? Whatever occurs to you at that moment. You have no real control over. There's no free will in this. Like you'll just react with something. If I tell you I'm going to come up with a color in the next hour, and I'm going to ask you to like come up with the first thing you think of at that time, even if you pre-plan it, you probably couldn't figure out like what you're going to say at that time, which is interesting. So the will is largely an illusion, but when you when you observe this, it's pretty cool. But here's the thing, like in your brain, you have a lot of different things that you could probably associate with the color blue. In fact, if you start writing them down, you could probably come up with like hundreds of things that you might have seen or associate with the color blue. So your database is quite large. But like why you tend to fixate on blue t-shirts and I tend to fixate on blue flags and someone else tends to fixate on blue water. That's an interesting thing about the formative sort of like the nature of the state of your brain versus someone else.
What I think what basically an LLM does mimic the brain is like when you train it, it basically forms these kind of clumps, but it's just by vectors in our brain. So it's like these clumps where information is accumulated on a certain topic. Like, for example, let's say blue, you build all these vectors to whatever contains the blue information. And then later on, LLM is very easy, or has an easy time to actually sort it out and find this information quickly and address it and find some solutions to it. In our human brain, is like our learning takes time, right? And what when this time progresses, actually, I think we really cluster the information. So I would say we probably have something like everything that's stored regarding to blue is actually in a certain region of your brain, right? There's some cells that are accumulating and storing the information over time that are all in the same area of the brain dealing with blue, right? So that's, I think it's a physical proximity in a human brain that's related to whatever information.
We have basically like electrical neural nets essentially storing this in real time.
Yeah, and
like
they have to be based physically close to
it. It's not even clear that it's structural, because you know the Penrose, Roger Penrose, like postulated that like this information was the memories of these things are sitting in maybe microtubules or something, and maybe there's some quantum mechanical reason why it works. But so far nobody's actually come up with an actual reason to have that. You have to have a quantum mechanical explanation for any of it. Especially when you look at
guess would just be it grows like that, like it's accumulating the information for this is accumulating in a certain point in your brain.
Yeah, I mean, like it's like the electrical field itself may carry a lot more than you think, like which is really strange to imagine. But the surface EEG stuff that's happening now, where people are actually able to attach an EEG to your brain and actually talk using your thoughts and have it come out, you know, with an LLM, like basically a diffusion model, like looking at what you're saying and, you know, spitting it out. That's super interesting. And then of course, like the fact that there is a structural element to this is certain, because if you look at the chemical way that a functional MRI and, you know, these types of things work, functional SPECT scans and whatever, basically you have spectrographs and you have like this color graph of your brain, and you can take that, interpret it through a diffusion model and exit with like images of giraffes and shit. So like, it's interesting that there, on the one hand, you have information that's coming from the electrical structure of your brain, which is just surface EEG, and that can be translated into literal language and words. And on the other hand, you can take an image of the metabolic activity of your brain, and you can get things like images out of your occipital cortex. The two of those things combined, it's like, holy fuck, like that tells you a lot. And those things were only discovered over the last 15 years, you know, overall. And then the LLMs, diffusion models, being even better at interpreting that data has resulted in some interesting stuff.
This will be like the lie detectors will get so much better, you know. So much better.
Yeah, it's not going to be good. I think most of the human race isn't ready for that shit.
I mean, there's some
lie detectors. What do you mean?
Yeah, it's like you will be able to much easier tell if someone's not telling the truth, because they might think about that crime in that particular moment, and you will be able to kind of extract that.
Oh, you're talking about EEGs. Okay. I thought you meant like the LLMs are developing lie detection. Okay.
No. That too will happen, because like the ability to detect like inflections in people's voices, this, that, and the other thing, like these things are gonna be pretty good at that shit too.
Yeah.
So you combine all the multimodal things we've seen with AI, surface EEG, functional scanning, and yeah, like interrogation takes a whole nother level.
That would be
not good.
That would be terrible for human nature, because it's in our nature to lie. Humans lie a lot.
And not only that, but a lot of things that we say might like be sort of white lies in a sense, but are not meant to be. And on top of that, we think of a lot of things in our head in terms of like, let's say you're being interrogated by someone and someone says, "Hey, did you murder so and so?" In your head, you're going to free associate the idea of like stabbing someone, because like that's just how your brain works. I mean, it's like you're gonna think
that's still a cool application, but just imagine you have like these Apple goggles or something, right? And you talk to someone and it's like he's saying something and it's like bullshit. It's like completely
if you're gonna be able to differentiate between memories of something you actually experienced versus simply a thought that you had that isn't actually a real memory. And I think they covered this a little bit on that movie. What's it called? The Tom Cruise movie. You mean, damn it, the thought police one.
The precog, these guys, right?
Yeah, the precog thing.
What was the report? Minority Report.
Actually. Minority Report, yeah. Conceptually, they considered this possibility in that, like, there are thoughts that actually, like, a human being has that turn their actual crimes. There are thoughts that you have that are actual memories versus those that are just acting in your brain.
Yeah, definitely. You can make predictions. Like, this guy expresses thought patterns that are likely to...
Right, into, more serial killer life.
Yeah.
Yeah. In other words, if some dude's walking around the planet and every 6 minutes he's thinking about raping somebody, or every time he sees a woman, he's like, ooh, he's like getting like extremely sexually aroused. Uh-oh, maybe he's a little bit freaky. Right? And like, maybe you should like watch this guy. So this is going to be a problem though. Like, you know, because really like human beings, we have like sociopaths walking amongst us all the time, but they don't always act upon their shit. The problem is that like, once you live in that kind of police state where you worry about that, it's just going to, it gets nasty really quickly. And if this technology is too easy, like to implement, like maybe worth it. So here's the thing. Like I would have thought if you'd have told me that you can extract fucking images out of someone's head using, you know, like an MRI scan, basically a functional MRI scan, I would have been like, get the fuck out of here. Really? Like, how would that even be possible? But then again, like that wasn't possible. Diffusion AI models to do imaging wasn't a thing 10 years ago either, but yet here we are. And then when you add that from the brain data, I'm like, that's one of the most profound implications ever of anything. Like the fact that you can just take a color spec image of your brain and like extract giraffe pictures and, you know, whatever the person was looking at the time.
Well, the interesting thing about that, and I'm glad that you brought up like where these things are stored, because I also have no fucking idea. But I know that
some things we know where they're stored. Well,
I would assume we know like things like long-term potentiation, but I don't know where. But
right.
But what we do know is that, or at least I would assume that a lot of those memories are stored like in the pathways, because one of the things that allows us to understand EEGs is that it's common among all humans, like. We know that the brain is nuanced and all brains are different, but if I tell you to think of a giraffe and I also think of a giraffe and I tell Noob to think of a giraffe, the same pathways will light up. That's how we know that a person's thinking about a giraffe, which is really interesting.
Yep. And there's a certain level of customization on those scans too, because they do some like, what do you call it? Like test images. Like they'll show you a picture of a gorilla, and then they'll prime the device to sort of like recognize that first, and then they kind of go from there. So there's a little bit of priming effect, but still, it's very, very similar. Blind
people would.
It's very similar.
Wait, I'm going to look into that, because would a blind person light up the same pathways when thinking about a giraffe? I'm curious.
I guess it's assuming they've seen one before or something, right? Like, I don't know.
Well, I wonder how blind people visualize things.
Well, we know how the occipital cortex works, because like you can see where visual field cuts affect you. So for example, if you were so the way that your eyes work is like a double set of pinhole cameras, and you have a mixture of pathways from your left eye and your right eye, both conglomerating on your occipital cortex, and they're upside down and inverted. So left is right, right is left, up is down, down is up, right? Like that's how the image looks on the back of your occipital cortex. And if you have a stroke or something in your occipital cortex, or have a damage to it, then you'll get a visual field. Let's say the upper, you know, occipital cortex, you know, on the right side of your brain, you will actually have a visual field cut in both eyes on the opposite side of the brain from the eyes that, you know, you got affected. So you maybe your lower left eye on both sides is not going to be, you know, you won't be able to see properly. And that's really kind of interesting. And so sight, like brain blindness, is different than eye blindness.
Oh my God. I had a, do you know what optic neuritis is?
Uh-huh.
I had optic neuritis like years ago. And it was so bizarre, because I didn't realize that I had a quarter chunk of my left eye. It was like, if you sliced my eye in the four pie slices, there was a quarter of that gone. And I didn't see it. Like, I didn't realize that I couldn't see.
Right, that's the other thing. Your brain
into things. I was like,
your brain will make it up.
Yeah, it in the same way that you don't recognize like the space in between your eyes. You just see like one thing. When you stop seeing something, you don't see like black or anything. You literally see nothing. And so experiencing that was wild because I would read something and I'd be like,
and remember
what?
Your,
what did I just
remember read? Where your remember where the optic nerve hits the was the fovea or whatever. I can't remember all the eye parts. I don't deal with eyes very much, but like, so there's a blind spot where your optic nerves enters your eye and it's, you know, it's like 30 degrees or something, you know, to the left of your vision. And you'll can do the experiment where you put a dot on a piece of paper and you keep moving across the side of your peripheral vision until it disappears. And what's magical about that is that one, you could have like an object flying at you and not see it. Right. And but your brain just fills in the space. Like when you walk around, you don't notice this because your brain just makes up that space. It just like fabricates reality as you walk around, which is really, really interesting.
Yeah. I thought also I might be wrong about this, but what you're talking about with the occipital, I thought that the reason I thought that the occipital just like inverts the image. I think your eyes are actually upside down. Like they process things upside down.
No, it works. No, it's because the lenses of your eyes work the same as a pinhole camera. So the image does in fact get inverted and projects onto your retina inverted already because it's just the way light moves, not because your eyeballs are bright.
Okay. Right? Okay.
So it's like a pinhole camera where, you know, you've done that thing where you have a box and you put a pinhole in it. And then you know how you can get your, you know, you can get a shoebox and do this. Anyone can do this. You just basically do the science experiment kind of thing where you poke a hole in the shoebox and you basically can take the image of the room around you and shine, you know, it'll actually shine onto the back of the box.
Can you like commit?
It'll be upside down and inverted, basically, so right?
The occipital is what makes you experience it upright or?
It's the part of the brain that receives the image signal from your eyes and then processes that and then you can utilize that information for the rest of your brain.
So if we like took a brain and we put a little hole in that spot, would they just be upside down? Like what?
It would be the exact same. It would be the exact same thing. So if you like, again, it's the part of your vision that will be gone is the part of the vision opposite and inverted from the side of the brain that you put the lesion. That makes sense because it's like, right? So like, but it will happen in both eyes, not just one, because both eyes cross on the way to the occipital cortex. So it's interesting. Yeah, what's interesting about that too is the when you have damaged that area, so a stroke and whatnot, then you will actually lose that part of your vision. It's called a visual field cut. That's why when you do like a basic neurologic exam, you're basically just taking your fingers in front of the person, you know, kind of like, you know, flicking your fingers up and down in the top left, the top right, around the entire visual field. And if someone says, I can't see that, then you know there's something wrong. But like you said, the brain compensates to a certain degree to where it's like brain blindness is different in that you think you're fine. Like it's not like there's a black spot there. Your brain just makes shit up. Which is really, really interesting how the brain works. So the brain is creating kind of a reality inside your head that is not so simple as just simply the pinhole camera shining a light on the back of a shoebox. There's more going on there. Because you have to remember, you're actually recreating this entire thing in your brain. And look at the fidelity that you can see with. It's unreal, right? Like, if you think about it, like, to evolve that, to get that level of vision is truly remarkable that, like, you can pack all that shit into a brain. But at the same time, when you look at how AIs are working today, if you look at how relatively simple and the simple number of connections necessary to generate sort of a diffusion model AI, even on your desktop computer, like if I don't know if you guys have downloaded these, but like try like Diffusion B, you can download it for Mac or whatever. And you can just like just stick pictures, you can have it do things like, oh, and it's like a 6 meg or 8 meg, I don't remember, 8 gig or something file. It's like a reasonable size file and size, you know, program. And you can just have it do like, you know how you do with Midjourney and shit. You can have it go like, oh, make me a, you know, draw me a house with a water fountain underneath it or something like, you know, and it'll draw it for you. And, but it's doing that with a very small amount of processing power that tells you like, wow, we're not that far away from superhuman level capability if A, our brains aren't as complicated as we once thought. There's a chemical and electrical field component to this. And you can actually extract, you know, words out of people's head using surface EEG. That's weird. And then you add that to the fact that the AI stuff is getting so good. And when you combine the two together, you can actually interpret the signals out of our brain much, much easier as well, compared to what we used to see, which is basically noise, right? We just see just a bunch of dots, you know, when you do an MRI of your brain. And, you know, but you know, obviously, like, the occipital cortex would light up if you're looking at something, or maybe if you make loud noises, that part of your brain is lighting up on the scan. But now it's like the level of detail that we can interpret this. And did you see that thing where they had, like, they were playing Pink Floyd, you know, like, you know, The Wall or whatever. They were playing the song, and they were playing the song, and they, I'm trying to think what they did. Yeah. So they measured the surface EEG while a person was listening to music. And then they took that recording and pumped it out of a diffusion model thing and was able to extract the song out of the fucking diffusion model while you're listening to a song. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. They were doing that years. It went back when I was in school. It's actually how they found that people with a certain type of autism actually.
But did you see the fidelity of the new one though? Holy
fidelity.
Shit. Meaning how good the sound was.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Like it sounds like the actual fucking song with the instruments and everything.
I haven't seen what you're talking about, if they've gotten like better at it, but we found like we were able to do this a long time ago. Just record. We literally were recording the electronic frequencies in the auditory cortex and then translating them to find when people have ear damage or auditory cortex damage. Like you can play back if someone has hearing problems, you can hear how they hear things, which is wild.
Right. So in this, yeah. And it's just that the difference now, I think, is that using the diffusion technology, you're able to extract a much more high fidelity sound that's more closer to the real sound, meaning like it sounded like Pink Floyd singing with like fucking band and everything. Like it wasn't like it, you know how like these things could be much more muffled, like as if you're like, you know, covering your mouth or something. So they're becoming much, much less muffled, and the fact that you can get that off a surface EEG is almost ridiculous, borderline ridiculous. Like it's like, wait a minute, like our brain is just working as this like gigantic.
But this was actually the memory, right? It's not just like they listened to the song inside of their head and then extracted that information and put it into
audio. I don't think so. I don't think that's what they did, because how would you get the whole band out of there then? Like,
oh well,
like, with that level of fidelity, like most, I don't know. I have to look. I didn't look at the actual study, but it was impressive.
I'm pretty sure, because I remember studying this. I'm pretty sure they it's like while the person is listening to it.
Yeah,
because they're recording
the.
Because every time you hear something, there's electrical frequencies that go on in your auditory cortex, and you can measure those, and they turn into sound waves. So we can hear when someone has hearing problems, because we can hear how someone's brain is processing sound.
Right, like high frequency hearing loss or something like that.
What I'm interested from that is we've known for a long time that people with schizophrenia or like with a specific type of schizophrenia, with DARPP32, it's like a mutation that causes auditory and visual hallucinations. We know that they have auditory activity in their auditory cortex. We found that these people exhibit the same frequencies as other people that are actually hearing things. So I'm very curious about that. I need to look into that if they've.
Some of these new, like these auditory implants that people are using are getting better and better too. Like the using bone conduction and different things to sort of like get people to hear again who've lost their hearing. That's fascinating. But there's also, if you add these new technologies, like what Neuralink is doing, it might be possible at some point to quite literally have an implant that goes into your brain. We know how to manipulate the electrical cortex, like the electrical component of the cortex, sufficiently enough to make a field very similar to how the brain makes a field and actually simulate that somehow. And now you can hear again or hear something, or maybe even like accelerated hearing, like, you know, Johnny Mnemonic type tech, you know, like where you're like getting better than normal.
Dude, what I'm thinking is like how fun it would be to have an implant and be a musician and imagine, because I'm always imagining sounds before I play it, before I make it. It would be so cool to like be in some VR world and just imagine my song and hear it immediately through my ears or something. But I guess like, the thing is, though,
it makes it too easy.
The sad thing is, though, it's like we could make stuff like that, but also musicians, I'm not going to have a job. I actually don't know what I'm going to do. Like AI is absolutely going to take over.
Especially when you can like inject, you know, sound into people's head and stuff, like that becomes a very different universe we live in. Like it's a very like. Life as we know it, like, is about to change substantially just based on what we've seen with that first Neuralink implant, like where you're able to control a fucking mouse cursor with your brain. Like how many people had that on their fucking bingo card to already be here by now?
I wonder like
what
the effect that it would have on the psyche, because I think humans have a need to fill a role. And so like, as far as being an artist or a doctor or I guess anything, at least my experience of it is you're striving for something impossible. Like you're striving for ultimate beauty that you know you'll never achieve. But it's,
what you're saying is the struggle matters.
The struggle matters. And once AI gets big enough, smart enough, it's almost like, well, I'm never going to win. Like,
yeah, it's almost like people that are like, okay, like there was that player that was really good at the game of Go. He was undefeated. And after AI, like, what is it? AlphaGo beat him. He's like, all right, I retire. Like my will to live is basically gone. Like what, why am I going to bother when I know for sure I can't, like, I'm going to be beaten by this thing.
Yeah.
And there is a sort of like societal level capitulation. I think it's likely to happen. I'm not convinced that these systems, when unfettered, and I mentioned this so many times, I'm unconvinced that unfettered, they're not going to have deep social, like psychologic one, but sociologic as a group consequences that are far reaching and completely unknown as far as how it impacts civilized society and everything else that we think of. I mean, we're pretty fucked up as it is in many ways, but like you add these sort of like unknowns in there. And this is why, like, you know how the EACC people have one set of ideas and the decelerationist people have another set of ideas. I sort of see it in the middle. I'm like, look, this stuff is inevitable at this point because you can make this shit in your garage these days. I mean, Jesus Christ. And so like you have diffusion models and stuff people are playing with in their house. So the age of like wondering whether it's coming or not is that time is past, and unless, you know, a meteor strikes the
people,
earth and wrecks us all or something.
Still argue with me like when I say I'm gonna lose my job, and I know this and I need to be thinking of career pivots, but I just don't know what to fucking do. I'm a one-trick pony.
Right,
people will argue with me and they'll be like, no, because people will always value the human element. And I'm like, I don't think you understand. An AI could scan me, everything I've ever made, and do me better. Do me a million times better than me.
Yeah, but I think so what the cope is nothing... there, I think people's imagination about how powerful these things are is like the midwit and the dimwit just doesn't get it. Like that, it's really that simple. Like you, like to most midwits or even people who are not like medically or like neurologically trained, the world is a magical place that seems like, it's a magical reality created by the nature of God. And, you know, everything is just pure magic and they live in that world. But when you break these things down into these nuances, like we're talking about here, we know that like gigantic job displacement and gigantic amounts of social chaos are coming. Because if you realize it affects your job, just imagine how many other jobs it affects. Most people's jobs, some level.
And photographers are already fucked. I feel bad for the photographers. Like I've gone to ChatGPT because I know some other musicians have already started using AI to cheat. And I know this because I've like, sometimes I have to work with other people and the AI isn't quite there with music. So I can hear it when I'm working with someone and they sent me an AI. It's actually really annoying, but the photographers are already fucked. Like, I don't need to pay an artist. anymore. I just don't need it. I don't need to pay a photographer.
Yeah, and AI is a little bit different in that, like you mentioned before, music, you know, there's certain chord progressions and whatever that like are generally in every other pop song. So to mesmerize most people is not that hard. And we have a lot, currently we have a lot of people attempting to mesmerize or entertain a lot of people. The difference is one AI could be quite good at entertaining most people. Right. So like the scale of like the, and the reach of that is not to be underestimated, I think.
Yeah.
And there will be some, like, there'll be a transition period where, you know, like auto tune and stuff or other technologies that emerge that like artists will kind of meld their shit with it and, you know, do cool things. But eventually, like, the amount of physical hours of work go down to do a similar task that you do now. And as that happens, right, like you wind up with
really
more.
Sad. It's like really daunting because you look at, or I look at my life, I look at all the hours of like just grinding and grinding and grinding. And here's this AI, and it's not quite up to me yet, but I see it. It's right on my fucking foot, dude. And it's coming fast.
Because you know what I struggle with? Like when I do any kind of like, when I've played with making electronic music, for example, like what I struggled with would be like, I know what sound I want. It's in my head. I don't know how to fucking make it, right? Like, I don't know how to make it out of like the little various little knobs and dials on the system, just to not bore people with the details of this sort of thing. And I know I could get there probably if I spent the whole fucking day tweaking knobs and dials, and I'd probably get somewhere close. But I'm not even sure I know how to do it well enough to get there, even if I did all day. I might have to take another day to figure it out. And by that point, my head is hurting and I'm bored. Like, you know how this works. Yeah. So then I was like, well, you know, it'd be nice if like in my head, I have a sound I want to create. And like, there's a way I could extract that and figure out how to get the right tools to make it. And just imagine how much faster that's going to be when you have an AI that can read your sort of like sense of maybe, you know, created sound in your head, theoretically. And then it can go through the library of the various sounds and things that it has available. It can sort of like try to replicate that and then even tune the, like, okay, I want this thing to have more reverb or whatever, you know, just for simplicity. And it's able to kind of like adjust based on, because you're going to be able to program these DAWs and stuff, by the way, Zin, by voice pretty soon, right? Like, so you're going to be able to say, hey, I want this thing. You know, I want this, like, you know, give me, you know, upscale this and like change it into this sound. And then blah, 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 and you're going to do it by voice anyway. And as you go along, the speed with which you can play with the permutations can be very fast, I guess.
When I think about the progression of this, I wouldn't be surprised if we got to the point where humanity was uninterested in music at all, just wasn't interested in it because of like, you start realizing that really what we're doing,
that's a meta
when we make
that's a meta. Yeah.
Well, no, but I mean, it seems like absolutely, it seems not only probable, it seems like impossible to avoid, because really what we're doing is we're going through all of this effort as artists to make someone feel something. And ultimately, if we like have chips in our brains with Neuralink in it, whatever, you can just press a button and feel everything you want to feel whenever you want to fucking feel it. There's not going to be a need for all of this. Like, I can imagine a world where art and music is just not necessary. You just don't.
It's almost like you have a psychedelic world on tap or something. You know,
yeah,
it's like,
you wouldn't need to listen, because for me, music and just sounds in general is the most beautiful, wonderful, magical thing that exists. But I do, and essentially, like, when I'm working, I'm just jacking myself off. Like, really, I'm just like auditorily masturbating. I mean, genuinely. But if I can just press a button and feel that feeling that I get from hearing a certain sound, why would I need to hear a sound? I wouldn't anymore. I wouldn't be interested in it.
Yeah, when you like get into this at depth, you realize, like, obviously our sensory world is this giant, like it's just this kind of latent space, and all the things we do to stimulate that space, that world is going to look very, very different quite soon. I wonder if, like, maybe there's going to be some magical kinds of spots in the brain, similar to how, I guess, I'm not sure exactly where they parked the sensor or whatever to get that handicapped person to be able to use a mouse with, you know, the Neuralink telepath thing. But imagine, like, there's got to be some really, really prime locations where you put little probes and you're able to extract the information. And, you know, from that, you know, you might have some very interesting experiences that come from that very soon. Like, I don't know what those are going to be yet, but like, if you would have told me that, like, oh, you just need this tiny little like thing attached to this little bit of the brain, and I'm going to be able to tell you how to, I can control a mouse with that, I'd be like, get the fuck out of here. Like, that the brain is that relatively simple. You can control a mouse cursor through a tiny, like, that probe is little. Like, we're talking about the size of, you know, those little lightning connectors on your iPhone or whatever. It's about that size. That's the size of the thing sticking into your brain. Not like, and it wasn't like you had to, you know, crack open the whole cortex. You just needed that one little spot or whatever. I don't know how they decided that was the magic spot or what, but like, Jesus, like, it's deceptively simple in some ways, which is even more worrisome, because it's like, if it's that easy to create, then we're going to have a gigantic world changing thing. Cause hard things to fix, like, I don't know, like hard things are like, if it's really, really extraordinarily expensive and out of reach to do, it's one thing. Right. But if it's something relatively inexpensive and relatively small to create with gigantic consequences, the whole world changes. Like, I think that proof of concept that they created pretty much was like world changing in every way we can imagine. It's truly like an earthquake level thing, and nobody noticed it almost. Or if they did, like, figured, it's just whatever. Like, you know what I mean?
Ever,
like,
play Grand Theft Auto.
Don't you find it's kind of weird that like the amount of attention that got was basically like a blip on the radar?
Oh, people don't care about anything interesting.
Yeah, it's that kind of like, and then the Overton window stuff is real, man. Like, Jesus.
Overton window? Wait, what is that?
You know, like this societal attention window thing where it's like, I don't know how to describe it exactly, but I know it superficially, but like, it's this idea that like, it takes a period of time before like the masses know about something, whether it's political or whether it's,
oh yeah, yeah, whatever,
right? Like, and then there's a delay period and then everyone's like talking about it, right? Like, yeah. Like, it doesn't reach that level of virality or whatever it is.
I'm guilty of that with politics. I like can't.
Oh,
I can't.
We're all guilty about it with something. Yeah. Like every one of us has our thing that we just like don't give a shit about until it's in our Overton window or whatever.
Yeah. When I first spoke to like elite people, high elite people, I told them, I was like, listen, I don't care about secrets of like Illuminati, world, like world leaders, people, whatever. I just want to know about alien shit. Like, I could not care less about what fat bald men are in a corner, like trying to rule the world. I couldn't care less.
I mean, if you can basically control a mouse cursor with a probe the size of a freaking lightning cable connector.
Yeah. Well, that's what, like, I was going to, have you ever played
the universe of like an advanced alien? If that, even something so straightforward as that's possible, would be so alien that like, we would like, there's no comfort. We wouldn't even be able to comprehend
world.
What that looks
like. Yeah. Have you ever played? I keep trying to ask that. Played?
They could literally be living amongst have us. You, like, that's what this means.
I wish. I want to meet one. Wait. Maybe they would be very boring to us.
No, maybe we wouldn't even see them. Like it would be quite possible that they live under the ground or whatever. Like, like, you just would, like, be a very funny thing though. Anyway, you were saying.
Have you ever played Grand Theft Auto?
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
Did you at any point ever do the cheat where you have like unlimited money?
I think so, yeah.
How did that go for you?
It got boring really quickly, didn't it?
Oh, fuck yeah. That's what it makes me think of, is like the human world. It's like all of the things that pain me probably make life interesting. And without them, I'm not sure I'd want to keep playing.
Like, the cheat code is not good. Yeah.
It's a boring game.
I like the cope where people say, hey, if AI takes over this, this, and this, you'll have more time for meaningful things like spending time with family and blah, blah, blah. Dude, no, that's just not how the mind works. Like men can't sit around just spending time with family. They're going to lose their fucking mind. Like, that's like, this will not work. Like, there's family time, and then there's doing all the other things and things that you believe have meaning. And then they'll say, oh, you'll find new things with meaning. Like what? Oh, you're going to do art or something. Well, what if the art and something is already being done by that too? And then, or what if, like, you don't find meaning personally in doing art? Like, that may not be your thing. So yeah, like, there's a certain thing, like the idol's hands or the devil's hands and all those like phrases people use that like come from reality. Like, yeah, sociologically, that's my point. Like, AI things do not look good for like the foreseeable future from a sociologic perspective. And I think the canary in the coal mine has been the falling birth rate problem. The fact that nobody wants to have, a lot of people don't even want to have sex, quite frankly. Did you know that like sexual activity in the United States, at least, has dropped off precipitously? You might not think it because of, you know,
I'm not interested
porn and TikTok and whatever else, but no, but like generally, I'm saying societally, not you, but like general,
I'm one of them.
The amount of sex for people under the age of 30 has dropped dramatically, like at least by the surveys and stuff.
Just a scam.
It's a scam.
Like, it's a scam. Extinction level events. But didn't you see the Ectolife thing? That's the solution for this mm-mm. problem.
Oh, they'll always, create a bunch of like always talking robot, about. Create a bunch of babies in a tank.
Yeah, 30,000 per building. I was thinking like I would love to work in a place like that. That would be fun as fuck. And you get to see the babies grow.
Sick. Yeah, the Ectolife thing's kind of a funny little internet thing that someone made up. Yeah.
Is it just made
it's
up?
It's not real. Yeah, it's just a little funny little website. Yeah.
Oh.
Someone made that up.
Wait, what
fun.
Do you mean? How do you know? How do you know it's not being made?
Well, I don't know. Someone just made it as a fun website, as far as I know.
Okay, but that's how things get made, right? Like, it starts it out could, in like, sci-fi yeah. books. Like, we have.
But no, it's not a intent to create anything. It's just like to make a fun website and make people talk about it.
Okay, but what I'm saying is like, but that's how things are created. Like, we had that with sci-fi books.
Like sci-fi, yeah.
Starts out in a sci-fi book, and then we have fucking telephones. It's like...
That's what they did that's what was in The Matrix, remember? Like, a bunch of babies being made.
Well, that's what I was thinking, too, is, like, if the world progresses to that point, I think most people would want to take the blue pill. Like, let's go back to where the world was a struggle and we had something to dream for. It's like, I wonder if I would take that, or if I would just become a boring... AI mesh.
I don't know. At one level, we have a ton of technology we didn't have before. Like, for example, TV, and we can watch faraway places. We can talk to faraway people, like we're doing right now. You have like tons of sort of like sensory augmentation type things that we're doing now. Yet. Most of us still enjoy doing relatively mundane, useless stuff, even though we have access to some of the most grandest technology the human race has ever seen.
Yeah, if you look at suicide rates, I don't know. I mean, we've already started seeing this in first world countries that have like, you know, we have a much, much, much better quality of life. Like the rate of people actually starving to death in first world countries is I don't even know if it's, unless you're like intentionally causing
self-harm,
someone.
But you're saying the self-harm rate and the desire to reproduce has gone down.
Yeah, right? And you see so many people wanting to die. Like, obviously, the struggle and the pain is
probably... Well, you could argue that it's basically linked, right? I mean, the more death and war and destruction there is, the more people tend to have sex because you just have to work against that force, right? But you're pretty safe on getting babies. You're not... It's kind of affecting your sex drive. It's like nature's way to regulate the population, right? So it's probably
there's an interesting concept
between the aggression that there is in warfare and the aggression that there is in sex, for example, right? So if people are really like ate up, I guess they just have sex more. Sort of, you know. I'm not sure if this makes any sense, you know, but it's like this kind of, it makes us docile. I think that's the way. Look at the panda bears, right? I mean, they're in a safe and sound environment, and they just don't want to have sex anymore.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Like, yeah, the we have to be poked and prodded, otherwise we just won't like We just won't go at it.
Yeah, only the scared apes fuck, you know? Sort of.
There's, at least as a woman, I see Anne down there. Maybe she can back me up. I don't know if men experience this, but at least as a woman, there are times in the month where I, like, become deeply sad that I don't have, like, a husband and babies. And it's once a month. It's like my hormones, and I know what's happening. But it's still, like, there's some sort of drive in the body that pushes you or kind of tortures you for it. Yeah, but then if you ignore it, but that's the thing, is like, if you're smart enough to realize, like, because if I didn't realize that it was my hormones doing that, then I would be like, oh my God, this is the worst thing ever. I'd go get a husband and have babies like immediately. But once you're smart enough to realize like, oh, this is a biological drive, then you just ignore it because you know it's going to go away.
There's definitely something there. I mean, my wife and my daughter, they get pissed at me once a month. It's like a given.
At some level, higher intellect, and ignoring some biological drives is how modern civilization actually was created, if you think about it, right? Like, if the only things you could think of was, like, you know, fighting the guy next door and then also, like, figuring out how to screw, you don't have time to do all the other things, like, you know, I don't know, invent, you know, fancy forms of entertainment and whatever else. Like, so at some level, like, that free time that gets freed up by not doing those base biological things is where that's where civilization sort of, like, in that is, that's the margin where that exists, I guess. Cause you could have, like, just a bunch of apes in the forest or whatever, and all they do is, like, mostly spend their time eating. I think, like, gorillas, chimpanzees, monkeys, like, all of them are interesting in that they have much, they have very different metabolism than us. They eat cellulosic food. They don't eat meat. So you have to take a way more time to digest and a lot more quantity of food. The smaller primates use that energy to jump around trees and shit and move really quickly, generally speaking. And the larger primates, like, need it for just sheer carrying around their body weight and attacking things or whatever. Like, so it's an interesting mix, but both don't spend too much time with cognitive activity. They're more, they're just basically going after their base biological needs for the most part the entire day, with a little bit of playtime in between. Like a little bit more playtime than, say, I don't know, like a fish or something. There was a Brazilian or South American, something like that. There's a TED talk of a lady who's a neuroscientist somewhere in South America, or Latin American country. Anyway, she talks about how, like, the big change was when human beings learned to cook food. You no longer had to rely upon, like, you could break down cellulosic material to pre-digest it basically by cooking. And then that dramatically changed the evolution of the modern human from previous primates and things, where we became the highest energy consuming brain on the planet per, like, mass. So if you look at the mass of our brain, and the, you know, per square inch or whatever you want, the density of energy usage went up dramatically. And the amount of time we had to spend eating cellulosic material, basically leaves and shit or whatever, that time went down dramatically. And, like, she postulated that essentially the magic ingredient was the cooking of food, which caused our brains to develop the way they did, because there's no other way to have actually had that much energy, like, otherwise, which is a very interesting talk. Like, it's worth watching that one. I don't know what the author's name was, but it was, like, definitely enlightening. She made some great points. And I think it was just pure theory. It's like a teleology discussion. There's no way to prove it, obviously. But there are a lot of, like, adaptations in human beings that would suggest this direction. Like, most other primates, or all of them, I think, are vegetarian for the most part. Human beings went to becoming omnivores, and we know this because of our teeth structure and everything else, and our digestive enzymes too, by the way. So we know, like, we're built for eating meat, and that's a change that occurred somewhere. So that evolved, like, simultaneous to our brain function. So food and the mind have been intertwined for quite a long time, in terms of, like, the evolution of our brain and how it works and stuff. Pretty fascinating
have
stuff.
You, I know I just asked about Grand Theft Auto, but do you play games ever?
I played a lot of games for a lot of years. I don't as much anymore.
You should.
Occasionally.
If you ever want to, you should play Ancestors. Which was.
You tell me about this.
Have I? Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned it at some point.
Because I love games that, like, show me. Because you can read about something, right? Or understand it conceptually. But then being able to experience it puts a whole new image on it. And in Ancestors, you basically go back, I believe it's 8 million years, and you have to evolve yourself into something closer to being a human. And you don't even make it, I won't say where you make it to, but it's just shocking how long, how many millions of years it takes to do very small things, like things that you wouldn't even, like it took us 2 million years to develop the ability to be ambidextrous, like the ability to be like, I'm going to take this rock with one hand and this other rock with another hand and boom them together. Like your brain doesn't, our brains back 8 million years didn't have that capacity. They could only use one hand to do things with. And so you're limited by like these capacities, and you have to like figure out how to survive with these limitations and then do things that allow you to evolve closer to us. And it's just very fun and very hard. It that game pissed me off a lot.
I think it's interesting though, like relativistically, like there are organisms on this planet that have remained largely unchanged for like the history of the planet, you know, certain ferns and whatever. Like there are certain things that like they found their niche and it was like, let's replicate like this for billions of years. And then there's other things like us and the velocity which evolution can happen on shorter time scales is pretty impressive. Like there's an island, and I'm going to get all the facts wrong here, but there's like an island, Caribbean island or something, and they know that like certain animal was never there because the settlers introduced that animal to that location. And like I don't remember what it was, the skin or the feathers or the feet, whatever, something about the characteristics of the animal evolved within like 50 years to change to be more like that particular environment, which is interesting because not many generations go by in that short period of time. And to me, that says to me, like, wait a minute. In that short period of time, like 50 years, you can develop a new type of like fucking foot or feather or something. Like that's fast. I mean, like, I don't know that you can explain that easily with natural selection. And that makes me wonder, you know, is there some sort of other mystical force at play here? And it sounds very woo-woo very quickly, obviously, but it's like, wait, how do you explain that speed?
Well, Martin and I butt heads here, but I'm pretty sure that the human genome or any genome has mutations like fit. Like we know for instance, if you get morbidly obese one time in your life, just once, and let's say you come from a long line of skinny, tall models, you get fat one time in your life, your child now could have that fat gene and grow up to be fat. Like we know that your actions in life impact your DNA. But also to that, they also did that with cave fish. They put fish in caves and very quickly, I want to say within like 3 years, all of the fish became blind. Just like cave fish.
Yeah, like how do you account for that velocity when in fact you have the genes to create like exactly sight, for example, and you're able to sort of like convert that to blind fish, and then the subsequent generations you put them in. So they put the subsequent generation into like normal ocean or whatever, and they couldn't see still or something, or
they put fish into, I can find it. They put fish just into caves because you know how cave fish, they're right. Blind. So I guess a group of people was like, why? What if we just put fish into caves too? And they found very, very, very quickly. I'll find it so I can find like the exact number of years it took, but it was very quick where the fish just started having blind babies.
I would be curious to hear the counter to that of, like, were the blind fish that were turned blind able to figure out how to see again faster than inherently blind fish? Like, something on a, have some type of control study?
Or you mean, like, to take cave fish into light and see if they develop eyesight?
Yeah, basically.
No, no, take the ones that went blind, take those subsequent generations, then can they get sight back quickly?
Yeah.
With a few mating cycles.
Can they get sight back faster than a cave fish inherently would be able to gain sight being placed in somewhere where they wouldn't need it?
I think. But here's where the woo-woo comes in, guys. What is the mechanism to translate the physical behavior into the genome of your progeny? Like, what the fuck is that? Like, even if you have the genes sitting there somewhere, magically they're hiding there somewhere to do these interesting things. Like, it's transmitted by what force of nature?
I think it's like the 10% like, that doesn't need to use it. They don't really use it, but then.
But my behavior, I'm walking around here in this building right here. Like I'm eating whatever, like that behavior gets translated to the genome of my progeny, you know, let's say it's a pregnant woman, for example, that would get translated to the genome. How?
Oh my God.
Right. Like there's no messages that we know.
I might've just found the answers. So I looked into this cavefish thing and there was a newer study in 2018, which is way after when I remember reading it. So they've looked into this and they found that fish, when they're babies, if there's no light, it's within a couple of days. I guess their body just decides we're not going to spend the energy to develop eyesight because there's no light here. It's within a couple of days while the baby is forming. Maybe it's something to do with this. Maybe
so it's inherent to their biology.
Like, maybe our DNA has stop losses or something.
But this is after the baby's born and it's in like darkness, or
yeah,
this is
that's
after...
what it says. It says within a couple of days, the while the eyes are forming, the eyes just don't form because the body recognizes.
Well, that's different though. That I get because the brain can't form correctly without the light stimulus. Like that goes to the occipital cortex or the cortex to actually do this, right? That's a little bit different though. I was thinking that this is like a heritable thing where somehow the physical experience of the parent, the baby is not born in darkness. It's actually born normally, but it's born with blindness just because the parents experience blindness. That makes sense?
No.
Like,
hold on.
Or no.
Wait, maybe I'm misunderstanding, or maybe I need more time to read.
We'd have to read this like fully.
Here, I'll link it.
Can you post it at the top? I think what Sefi's saying is he would like to see a litter that is populated and then half is taken to darkness, half is taken to light, and see what happens.
Right, something like that. Yeah, can you actually transmit something to the genome, the actual DNA of your progeny somehow with your actions? It'd be like if you would play music all day, you know, mother plays music all day, and then like the child's better at music, but it's not because the mother is genetically inclined to music. It's because literally playing music affected the genome somehow. That'd be weird.
Right. No, but I guess it's called epigenetic regulation. I posted it as a comment. And in where like you have these genes for the possibility of these things, but then as the baby is forming, I guess the DNA regulates itself for like, what do we need? Like, what are the surroundings? What do we need? We don't have.
But imagine the example of like the paw of the animal or the camouflage of the animal changes within, say, 50 years. That's a short time, though, for a physical structural change. We're not just talking about like one gene off or whatever like that. We're talking about literally the paw looks different or whatever. Like,
right.
And if you think about dog breeding, I mean, I guess you could argue that like dog breeding has been going on for, let's say, what, 100,000 years, and maybe cats even less or something. There's some statistics on this shit. But I guess it didn't take that long. And look how many different dog breeds we have. And they all came from like wolves or some shit.
But counter,
like, you know, like, as far as we know.
Counter to that, though, you've heard the statement that like if you can intercept a wolf within 3 to 4 hours of it being born, it will be inherently adaptive to whatever parent structure it has. So if you go and find a wolf that's a year old, it will inherently never trust you as its parent. But if you are able to intercept it and it's able to interpret your smell within, like, I think it's like 20 hours of being born, it will treat you as a child. It will treat you as an adult, or treat you as a
parent. I don't mean by the way, like wolf as in like the psychology of the wolf. I mean like how we've just created a bunch of dog breeds, you know, like everything from a German Shepherd to a poodle, and they're like look really different physically. It's amazing how much human breeding has changed dogs.
There is a lot of
psychology though matters quite a bit.
Of course. Yeah.
Like I like how
the domesticated animals. Yeah.
I like how you term it a woo woo, because there is so many woo woo things about genetics that are just wild. And the craziest one to me, where it's almost like, how the fuck does that happen, is they found, and I'll find the terms for this as well, but they found within groups of, I can't remember what animal it was, but this is like a whole field in biology, probably the most interesting part of it, in my opinion. But they found within groups of animals, there are two types of, and we're on the same page here that like your personality is pretty much genetic, right? At least you're on the same page with that, Sefi, right? Like you're genetically what you are. Like we can determine.
It's probably like, you know, 90-10 nature nurture or something like that, right? It's very high.
So they found that there are two personalities in many different types of species. One of them is kind of stupid, acts before it thinks, and the other is cautious and stays back and protects itself. And they found somehow these communities and groups, when they have babies, they will divide into the same percentage of the go-getters, I believe it's around 20%, and the ones that stay back, which I believe is 80%. And that 20 and 80%, we see that all throughout the world, around that percentage difference. But let's say you take out the animals that are the go-getters, like the 20%, right? And then all the babies from the remaining group have more babies, it will still line up to where it's 20% that go out and do things and take risks and take chances, and the 80% stay back. Somehow, you're genetically, you're the fetus knows in its community whether to be something that the society needs. Does that make sense? You also see this with like male and female. It's like, how the fuck?
Yeah.
How the fuck?
Jonathan, I mentioned this a lot too. Jonathan Haidt's work, you know, who did the sociology surveys of human beings, that like the proportion of left, right, and libertarian mindsets are not only proportional to each other, like it's like 45, 45, 10 or something like that, but it's also proportional all over the world, meaning it's like not different in China or India or wherever. And I think there was only one country was like slightly off, but like most of the planet, regardless of what supposed cultures humans have, like that heuristic, like nature sees fit that we have for some reason these three groups, because without them, maybe it's like, you know, human flourishing doesn't work as well or something. Like something has selected for that behavior.
We see this type of behavior in insects, ants that will like act as one, or there's a worm, because I know the ants have pheromones that allow them to, or we have explanations for that somewhat, but it doesn't fully explain, like there are worms that move together that will like constrict into one big worm and move around together. It's like, how the fuck does that happen? Like there's shit that's
some of the strange, like, yeah, there's some strange behaviors hard to like fully quantify exactly. Yeah, how much of it's like, you know, scientifically explainable with our current models, and how much of it's like woo woo?
I believe the leading explanation right now, which is being
studied, and by woo woo, I mean like there may be some sort of magical explanation or scientific one, but we just don't know what it is yet or something.
Yeah, I believe the leading one right now is pheromones, that there's a lot of data that is translated through smell to like, especially like pregnant women. Like we've found recently an explanation for why people have so many miscarriages. So we found, I think 2 years ago, that women that have miscarriages have a better sense of smell, the unexplainable miscarriages. And we found in other species of animals that when the female is pregnant and smells a male besides the one that impregnated her, they'll just automatically abort. So we're looking into that. I say we, but not me.
Does it matter if the male they smell is like a stronger perceived male, or is it just another male, period?
Well, so they found that it's just another male. They just abort it. I can't remember what animal it is, but that's what gave them the idea, like, wait a second, is that going on in humans possibly? And then they did a study with women, and how they did it is they had men sweat into t-shirts, and they found that the women that were able to figure out which scent, which t-shirt was their partner, those women had more miscarriages than the women that had a bad sense of smell.
Interesting. Right? Yeah, there's like a, it's funny though, like it always, these things seem like Pandora's black box things that you don't want to know about your world around you. Like when you know, it's like, uh-oh, there are probably like implications, and those implications have implications, right? It's like this like domino effect of like understanding these things. Like the farther we go, it's
we'd like start locking women in the houses.
Or who knows? But like the farther we go, it seems like the Garden of Eden and the Adam and the Apple story become more and more like poignant. Like how good that allegory actually is becomes much more and more like the farther we go down the rabbit hole. It's like, oh fuck, like almost none of the rabbit hole things definitively make us happier. In fact, it's the other way around. It's like superficial happiness, but like much deeper worry, and that like there are some things that are better left unknown. Like when you take the magic out of it, it's like not quite the same thing anymore.
What do you mean? I'm so happy that I found this study, because if I ever get pregnant, like, bye, world. Like, obviously, even if it's just still being studied, it's going to take years for them to conclude this. But
I don't mean this particular thing, but I mean just in the aggregate, all these things that we've been talking about tonight. It's like, it seems like it's just Pandora's box after Pandora's box.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, I gotcha. Yeah.
One thing to add. The study Sefi was talking about, not study, but just random talk, was Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human by Richard Ragam. Just talks about how us learning.
Oh, fire generally.
Yeah, talks about how learning how to heat food up made us more efficient as a race. I don't know. I haven't read it, so I'm not going to back it at all. But I Googled it.
The neuroscience example was not just the technological efficiency, but also that like quite literally our brains changed and our gut and everything changed as a result of cooking food. So we generally now cannot live without cooking our food. Like if you just start foraging and shit, we're going to have a hard time. Like we're going to have a hard time having civilization of this size.
I mean, it makes sense.
It's almost impossible. Right? Yeah.
Like I've done some wild runs. And like by mile, like 100, eating random like processed food, you're like, I need cooked food. It's like, I need rice, I need soy sauce, right. I need salt, I need actual cooked food.
The human brain actually uses, like, it's the highest energy consuming organ in the body in any given moment. It's like 25% of your, you know, glucose / energy needs.
Right, like my brain will feel like it's melting. I mean, people have run marathons and they say they've experienced a bonk. And I'm like, you've never experienced a bonk to like 87 miles into a 100 miler. And you're walking into a aid station and you're like, what is happening to my body? And then somebody hands you a cup of rice and you eat it and you're just, you feel so good.
Yeah, exactly.
Dude, I fasted for a month and a half last year because I wanted to see if I could do it. And I could.
That's crazy.
And I did. No, but the first bite of food I had, I swear to fucking God, it was the weirdest. I saw color, like the world became colorful, and I felt it like go through my whole fucking body.
I believe that, honestly. Like,
guys, I got a call to go do some emergent stuff. I've got to run. I might try to come back later.
But lucky
hang out.
Co-host.
Okay, we'll catch you later. No, I just got to drop off completely because I better use my phone.
Okay, bye.
Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come, first serve mentality stuck in the burbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of trash is under the dirt. We rape them under the earth, sit and wonder about the worth and play, ring around the rosy while the thunder is served. Motherfuckers walking around here looking faceless, trying to make a living selling friendship bracelets. Dead ends dragging out the max amount of payments. Red down days, got them acting all bankless. Yo fam, what? Check these tokenomics. They probing this bear, flexing broken honest. I had to lay my soul down, I'm just roasting otters. And then to end a long day, 11 bowls of chronic. Never known the politic, I was born to frolic. It's been my policy to pollinate all over the plot. We got a lot of apologists jumping in at the top. We like to measure their velocity before they hit rock bottom. Over impossible loss, it's all moss, and I'm liking the odds. Fondue in the morning, forming mycological bonds. Flick the cap, yo, the road is highly involved. Flip a coin, diary falls. Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come, first serve mentality stuck in the burbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of trash is under the dirt. We rape them under the earth, sit and wonder about the worth and play, ring around the rosy while the thunder is served. Trying to figure out the max amount of DNA stacked in non-toxic just to get a better place. Smacking on the hostage like the shit is play for keeps. Clowns, white knight, and all these Maybellines. They call it implausible when model after model keeps on ripping off the coat and going full throttle beats. Tearing apart your community, all these low-hanging fruits bearing zero liquidity. Got a planet in reach, coming standard to each. I'm on the back 10, stargazing after the siege. Commanding all the management to grab a few Z's, and then we'll round up the beasts and send a messenger east. Y'all better sign a release when I'm bumping these beats. Hands up if I got motherfuckers drumming the streets. Yo, we got a few dubs, we got a couple defeats, and if you're coming for the king, you better have some of each. Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come, first serve mentality stuck in the burbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of treasures under the dirt. We rape them under the earth, sit and wonder about the worth and play, ring around the rosy while the thunder is served.
Channel Spaces.